Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Amy Willens, sitting in for Ian Masters. I teach in the Literary Journalism Program at UC Irvine, and I also wrote a book called Martyrs Crossing, which is a novel about Jerusalem. Just last week, the two main Palestinian factions, Fatah and Hamas, reached a comprehensive agreement that would turn over the civil administration of Gaza immediately to officials of a Palestinian unity government led by President Mahmoud Abbas. The agreement, negotiated in Cairo, is designed to ease the long blockade of Gaza by Israel and Egypt and open the way to reconstruction of the war-ravaged coastal entity. I have Sari Makdisi here with me today, and we're going to be talking about Gaza and its future. Sari is a professor at UCLA, and he's the author of Palestine, Inside and Out, and Everyday Occupation, as well as, more recently, Making England Western, Occidentalism, Race, and Imperial Culture. He's written about the Palestinian situation for such publications as the LA Times, the London Review of Books, The Nation, The Washington Post, and Salon, among others. Hi, Sari. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Before we talk about this agreement, let's try and get a bit of a long view today. One thing I think gets lost in the discussion of Gaza, of its past and of its future, is what exactly life looks like there now, under occupation, under blockade, and in the aftermath of another round of indiscriminate bombings. Do you think you could tell us a little bit about what it's like to live there in terms of the everyday things in life, like water, food, electricity, schools, healthcare, sanitation?
Yeah, I mean, it's about as run down a situation as you could possibly imagine, in the sense that it's deliberately run down. I mean, it's not like a natural disaster. This is a situation that's been deliberately, methodically, and in the most calculated, literally calculated way, down to the last calorie in some cases, a situation of oppression and micromanagement of human life. But in really to understand the situation in Gaza, you have to understand that most of the people who live in Gaza now aren't really from Gaza. They're the refugees or the descendants of refugees from other parts of Palestine. So actually about 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip comes from other parts of Palestine. And really, they don't belong in Gaza. They can't really fit in Gaza. And they're not in Gaza by choice. They're there because they or their families were expelled during the creation of Israel in 1948. So that's the number one most important thing to understand about Gaza. People there want to go back to where they came from in the rest of mostly southwestern Palestine. But then in terms of everyday life, life under siege means you can't come and go freely, you can't import and export freely, you can't really even go to school freely because certain school materials are subject to interdiction, and even when they're available, the situation of massively overcrowded infrastructure also applies to educational infrastructure. One of the amazing things about Gaza is that it's an overwhelmingly young people, young population. More than half the population is under the age of 18. So it's this huge kind of sea of children, all of whom have, you know, immense, because of Palestinian cultural inclinations, immense educational drive, with, you know, fewer and fewer educational options. It used to be possible in the old days, meaning before the Israeli siege of the 2000s, it used to be possible for students in Gaza to be able to go to universities in the West Bank, for example, or in East Jerusalem. That's no longer possible. When Gaza students get scholarships to study overseas, I'm talking about university students, they have to face a whole parade of things even to be able to get out of Gaza, let alone to come back in. Those are imposed by the Israelis, and often they're not let out at all. So we're talking about a life that from the ground up has been gradually stripped, withered away, cut down, again, deliberately, methodically. And so then you have to imagine yourself there looking out at a world where, you know, you want to fish, but you can't fish. You want to grow something, but you can't. You want to study, but you can't. You want to grow up, but you can't. And you have to ask yourself, well, what are the options in a situation like that? Clearly, the most important thing is to develop a kind of political resolution that allows the people of Gaza to live what everybody in this world deserves, which is a normal life. And, you know, we're not anywhere near that happening yet, unfortunately. But that's what life looks like in a nutshell from the ground up.
So it's a collective punishment, as has often been said about the Gazan population, that they're being collectively punished for the installment of the Hamas government there. But what really does this serve for Israel's purpose to collectively? I mean, what could be a rationale among a sane people for doing this to its neighbor?
Well, it's not actually punishment as such. Mm-hmm. What it is, in a more specific sense, is it really is a kind of corralling and restricting of what's regarded literally by the state as a superfluous population. This is a population that the state of Israel doesn't want to have in its territory. On the other hand, it also doesn't want to let it go and, you know, let it live life, you know, as an independent mm-hmm. state, which is what the state of Palestine would be. So it's this population that's neither within the state, nor is it allowed to, nor is it granted independence in a normal kind of sense. So it's not that they're being punished exactly, you know, it ends up being punishment of a kind. So the point is, the logic isn't punishment. The logic is, this is a people that really we need to keep under check, kind of basically locked up, because there's no need for them. There's no need for their labor, for example. I mean, in the old days,
yeah, there used to be.
There used to be a use for Palestinian cheap labor. Now that no longer really applies. So they don't need the labor, and they don't want the people, because for reasons that are quite obvious. If the logic of Israel is to be a Jewish state, having an extra 1.5 million Palestinians from Gaza inside Israel would obviously negate its claim to Jewishness, or severely complicate it. And so, well, what do you do with these people? If you let them free, then their independence seems to Israel to pose a threat of some kind. So you don't let them go, but you don't let them in either, and it ends up being this open-ended limbo. And of course, what happens in Gaza, it has to be said, is just a larger scale version of what happens in other parts of Palestine. You know, the West Bank is riddled with areas that are smaller than Gaza, but nevertheless have the same kind of siege-like situation. Gaza is worse, it's more extreme, it's bigger, but it's exactly the same logic. Basically, what it comes down to is an entire population that's not being allowed either to have independence and then go on to live a normal life, nor is it able to be integrated into a state that treats all of its citizens equally.
Right, and this is why the wall became such a symbol, because it effectively made physical what is the general policy of Israel toward these people.
Yes, exactly. It's imprisonment and corralment. But like I said, the logic isn't that of punishment. It really is there's just too many people of this particular kind that don't fit in the matrix of the state, so let's park them here and, you know, not let them go, and
right.
and yet not let them live. And it's sort of, that's fundamentally what it's all about. And of course, there's Israelis have no end of thing about threat and violence and all the rest
right.
of it. And of course, there is some, I'm not saying there isn't violence, but on the other hand, you know, if you were part of a corralled population, you might also think about what violence means from the other way around.
The problem is also that any people who's corralled like this and kept like this in these conditions naturally might think about violence every once in a while.
That's always happened historically in situations like this. So again, we come back to the point of, well, why don't we end the corralling, and why don't we find means to live in peace and have a peaceful resolution of the conflict? That's clearly what's necessary in any case. I mean, that's the big picture, obviously.
It seems so odd to me over and over and over to have this conversation as the years wind past us, and for us to always be saying, you know, it's clear what needs to happen, it's clear what needs to happen, but the two parties there don't seem to feel that way. Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's because one party has no power and the other party has almost absolute power at the political and diplomatic level, in any case, as things stand. In other words, Palestinians can make, like, the agreement they just made recently. They made an agreement similarly a few months ago.
I know.
Which is what actually led to the Gaza War to begin with.
Exactly.
Right? So they can make all the agreements they want. They can sign all the declarations they want. They don't actually have any power. So they can talk about their controlling the Gaza Strip. They're not really, I mean, it's not, the Palestinians don't have a state. They're not in control of anything. They can't import and export. They don't control the infrared spectrum. They don't control airspace or borders or water. They don't even control their own population registry. To have a Palestinian ID card issued. It's the Israelis who have to approve it, not the Palestinians themselves. They have no control over anything, really. So it's kind of absurd to talk about the Palestinian government exercising control, etc. It's a kind of elaborate fiction. On the other hand, the Israelis, of course, have huge power, and above all, they have the power, the unlimited power, endlessly ratified by our own government, both the executive branch and the legislative branch, to basically go on doing whatever they want to do. Because whatever they do, the U.S. always... The U.S. may hem and haw, but in the end it always says we support Israel.
It hems and haws, so, but if you give a carte blanche, then it's not a meaningful
thing. But, you know, you go on doing what you're doing. It will hem and haw a little bit. The Congress never seems to hem and haw at all. The executive, every now and then, may say something like, we regret, or this is unfortunate, or it's not productive, but that doesn't actually do anything. So if you just think about it rationally, if you're a power that basically has carte blanche by the only superpower in the world and unlimited power support at the UN and financial support and everything else, well, why would you do anything else? I mean, you've never been told no. You know that the support's always going to be there. So
just behave as you wish to behave.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, but there are two issues with this. One is Israel's suicidal impulses, which, you know, to me, to hold the Palestinians close and never let them go has destroyed the two-state solution. So I think it's been really kind of crazy on the part of Israel. But the other thing is, I just want you to explain to me better why an agreement between two Palestinian entities who've been at loggerheads is not important. I understand its Kafka-like qualities, like what are they really going to control? But on the other hand, for them simply to hold hands should be at least morally meaningful and possibly politically meaningful, even if it's not a means of violence to take control of any government.
No, I mean, let me go back to the first question you're asking about the Israeli rationale for all this. The point is that there is no rationale, and there's in order to develop rational thinking, you also have to have, at a certain point, a logic of costs and benefits. We should do this if we pay this price. It's not worth doing it, et cetera, et cetera. But if you live in a world where there is no price, where there seems to be no price, it's extremely difficult to develop a kind of rational, logical approach to what we should and shouldn't be doing. Now, there are, of course, Israelis who say, you know, including former government ministers and prime ministers and whatever, who consistently say this is a mistake. We really are destroying any possibility of a two-state solution if we keep on doing this. But that requires a certain degree of rational capacity, which the government doesn't seem to have because, as I said, it's always been told, go on, do whatever you want. So, like I said, it's like a child that's never really grown up. It's never had the chance to develop the capacity to say, you know, should I, shouldn't I, what, you know, what are the price if I do this kind of thing and so forth. As for the Palestinians, I mean, in a way, I mean, it's a symbolic gesture, first of all. What it does is it reaffirms the unity, at least theoretically, the unity of the Palestinian, you know, kind of political echelon. But, again, unity to do what exactly?
Well, for instance, the Palestinian officials said the agreement would allow them to take control of the border crossings of the Gaza Strip, including Rafah. Is that true?
No, of course it's not true, because they don't control the borders. I mean, the people who are in control of the borders are ultimately the Israelis. And the imports and exports to Gaza, they don't go via Rafah. They go through the border checkpoints that the Israelis control, Erez and Kerem Shalom, another one. So Rafah itself is for people coming and going. It's not set up to transport goods and, you know, materials
and to keep a country alive, right?
Yeah, and of course it's not a port or an airport. I mean, if you're talking about sociologically a modern space, you know, with big urban infrastructure and so on, you need facilities to import and export. So it's not just like a little gate that people could walk through, right? Which is essentially what Rafah comes down to. So in that sense, on the ground, it's at best a symbolic gesture. But what the Palestinians really need to be able to do is to mobilize the vast international support, especially at the level of ordinary people that they really do enjoy. I mean, which is an extraordinary thing that they have, that the Israelis actually don't have. The Israelis have lots of friends at the level of Western governments, essentially, and even that's beginning to shrink somewhat. But that's where their support is. The Palestinians have support
grassroots
at the level of ordinary people all around the world in their hundreds of millions, which is an extraordinary thing to have. But what they need to be able to do is to speak with one voice and to make very clear that what their demands are. And the thing is, Fatah and Hamas between them don't have a very clear articulation of what their struggle is ultimately all about. at least not one that sort of addresses an international audience. And that's a fundamental problem for the Palestinians. There are many, many eloquent spokespeople for the Palestinian cause, but they're not really in either Fatah or Hamas. Neither of them really have a blueprint or an agenda for how to move this sort of stalled situation to a new level, what the ideal outcome would look like for them.
So, if neither party has a blueprint for the outcome, maybe I can ask you what you see as the near future, the next 5 years for the Palestinians.
I think it's not just me. It's what most, or increasingly large segments moving towards most of Palestinian civil society believes in, which is the material fact on the ground that there is no longer room for the creation of an independent Palestinian state. It's been colonized, eaten up by Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. I mean, there are 500,000 right. Jewish settlers in those spaces now. There just isn't room for the creation of an autonomous Palestinian state. And the Israelis have made it clear over and over again that they're never really going to let such a state really exist. So then the Palestinian struggle has been shifting in the past 2 years, and it'll continue to shift, I think, in a sharper fashion towards the creation of moving away from the kind of classic national liberation struggle, which is what it was in the 1960s and 70s, to a struggle for equality and justice in the parameters of a single state. I mean, it's unquestionably where the Palestinian struggle is heading now. It's been heading there for a while. And in a way, the irony about the Fatah and Hamas deal is that those two parties are kind of the last ones to the table, in the sense of Palestinian civil society having set the agenda, and these sort of political leaderships are kind of Johnny-come-lately beginning to realize that the talk of a single state, of a two-state solution is basically over. And what we need now is a situation in which all Palestinians and also all Israelis can achieve their rights. And the only way that I and many people can see is to create a single state in all of what used to be Palestine, today's Israel, the occupied territories, in which all citizens are treated equally.
And, right, and the idea of the Jewish state is gone.
Well, the idea of a Palestinian state is also gone.
Right.
The idea of any kind of exclusive state is gone. Yeah, that's the reality. I mean, we both peoples can want to have this, vestigial notion of an exclusive mm-hmm. state, but the fact of the matter is there are millions and millions of people and they're all on top of each other, and we can go on pursuing these ideals of separate states for separate peoples and all that, but there's a very sort of sharply human interruption of those rhetorical arguments, which is the fact of millions of people living in close proximity to each other, and in ultimately, deliberately, I think, inseparable ways. So,
right.
We can go on talking about separation, but if people are living with each other, I think it makes much more sense to say, okay,
let's live together.
As equals. Yeah, and then find other ways. There are many, many other ways, both for Palestinians and for Israelis, to articulate identity and cultural, formations and all that kind of thing. You don't have to have. I mean, the modern state is a really, really recent invention in the history of the world, and it's not really ever been proved clearly that's the ideal sort of social political construct for people to aspire.
Well, we'll have to see what the idea of one state provokes over the next few years between the two peoples.
Yes.
It's certainly going to be, as usual, interesting. And thanks so much, Sari, for coming on the show.
Sure, my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. We've been talking to Sari Makdisi, a professor at UCLA, and author of Palestine Inside and Out, An Everyday Occupation. Now joining us is David Myers, the chairman of the UCLA History Department, who writes frequently about the conflict in Israel and Palestine for the Jewish Journal and other publications. His most recent article in the journal was called After Gaza, The Trail of Destruction and Its Costs. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy. Great to be here.
So during the first half of this segment, we talked to Sari Makdisi about what life is like in Gaza. But now I'd like to discuss with you what you see as the future for Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel in the wake of this summer's disastrous war and the new agreement. First of all, what do you think the two sides learned from their latest engagement, if anything?
I don't think they actually learned that much. I think that when we look at the balance sheet of this conflict, we see massive destruction, 2,000 people dead, over 2,000 people dead, tens of thousands of homes and businesses destroyed, billions of dollars of damage. No significant alteration of the military status quo I don't see much progress on the diplomatic front. We're no closer to justice for Palestinians. There's no greater security for Israelis. And it seems to me that we're simply at a point of a brief respite before another round of fighting between Israel and Hamas. The one thing that might be said to be seen as a step forward is indeed the agreement between Hamas and Fatah, which does open up the possibility of a new political and diplomatic horizon. It seems to me that is an essential precondition of any successful negotiation process.
And yet, of course, that agreement was about to happen before the last round of war broke out. So one wonders, really, how much the Israelis are listening to this. Yet, I was reading in The Guardian an editorial where they said, basically, this agreement is happening, this clock cannot be turned back, and that Egypt is moving toward asserting its role on behalf of the Palestinians rather than simply being, you know, a rubber stamp for Israel in the in the conflict.
Well, I do agree with that. I do think that this this agreement is indeed reflective of Egypt's desire. I do wonder whether Israel, at least in its current political incarnation, regards this as a positive development. There is a kind of long-term perspective on the part of Zionist and subsequently Israeli leaders toward the Arab side. There has been a recurrent refrain, really from the 1920s, that we Zionists or Israeli leaders would say, we have no partner for peace. And it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And one does wonder, and one does fear, that that belief has become so deeply ingrained that even when you have the prospect of a new political horizon, they will fail to see it. For example, Defense Minister Bogi Moshe Yaalon said of Abu Mazen's recent speech, it was a clear indication that we have no partner for peace. It's that recurrent refrain that I think assumes a life of its own and, in fact, may prevent Israeli leaders from seeing that, in fact, there is a shift and there is a new sense of urgency. I think the Egyptians see that sense of urgency, that something has to shift on the Palestinian front in order to attend to other much more pressing concerns in the Arab world.
It's interesting because the partner for peace, I was just about to say to you, it all depends for the Palestinians on whether they have a real partner for peace in Israel. So that it's a typically Israeli thing where the thing they think about the other is really the thing that they're doing themselves.
Right. You know, I have to say, in the name of equal representation, I think both parties are culpable. I think there's a lot of right in the historical experience of the two groups. I think there's a lot of wrong in the way they've gone about it. And I think both share responsibility for missing opportunities to seize upon new initiatives. In this case, clearly Israel has the upper hand in terms of military and political strength. Clearly it is the stronger partner in the negotiation process. And as a result of that, I think it has an added responsibility to create a viable partner with whom it can negotiate. And it has failed to do that again and again. And I think quite apart from its capacity to engage in military operations that may be deemed successful or not, what we see is a total absence of Israeli statecraft. There's no sense of the imperative of finding a credible partner. There rather is this retreat to the refrain that we have no partner. And it must be terribly frustrating to responsible parties on the Palestinian side to see that. Here, I really do think that Israel has bears the burden of responsibility for building up a credible partner, of which there seems to be a living specimen in the current president of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen. Despite his recent rhetoric, he's as good as it's going to get, and the new unity government with Hamas is the essential precondition to a successful negotiating process. You can't have Israel negotiating just with Abu Mazen and leave behind Gaza. You need to have some version of Hamas in the negotiating process. And in this rather secondary and junior position, that creates the conditions that Israel should ideally hope for.
Exactly. I mean, it's amazing that he got it.
Yeah, absolutely. But as was said of another people, namely the Palestinians, by a famous Israeli leader, they don't miss opportunities to miss opportunities.
Right. And again, just like the Partner for Peace, that bounces back to the Israelis.
Yes. I'm thinking of the Israelis in that regard.
Right.
I'm thinking of Netanyahu, who really, in the wake of the Gaza war, in a certain sense, had the ideal Nixon in China conditions. He had tremendous popularity at home, tremendous unpopularity the world over. So he had political wind at his back at home, tremendous external pressure. This would have been the moment,
right,
if he had it in him, to actually go to Ramallah and say to Abu Mazen, I understand that this senselessness cannot continue. This simply cannot continue. After the death of the four teenagers, the three Israelis and one Palestinian, after the deaths of more than 2,000 people and billions of dollars of destruction, which of course follows on a conflict in 2012 between Israel and Hamas, which follows on a conflict in 2008-9 between Israel and Hamas, that would have been the moment to come and say, we must stop this madness, and I extend my hand in peace. And
but he didn't do it. Now, is that a failure of statecraft, as you said? Is it a failure of imagination? Is it a psychological problem of one leader? Or is he appealing to a kind of new Israel that is unwilling to take that imaginative leap and say, okay, we're not going to live forever with this enemy. Maybe it's an Israel that wants to have that enemy constantly at its door.
Yeah, I think it's all of the things that you mentioned. But I do sense that we can see some historic shifts, even from the time of Ben-Gurion, the first Israeli prime minister in 1948, to Netanyahu, which is to say, Netanyahu, I think, is not out in front of his people in missing opportunities. I think he's squarely in the midst of his people in believing that that there's no real urgency or incentive to achieve a negotiated solution with the Palestinians.
You wrote recently, Israel is no longer the plucky little country caught in a sea of powerful and hostile neighbors, a scenario that was not exactly accurate even in 1948. It is now the Goliath of the region, possessed of the most powerful military force and sophisticated arsenal. The kind of massive damage it can and does deliver serves only to promote the image of an indifferent bully. This is exactly how Israel's Palestinian and Lebanese neighbors regard it, as do a growing number of Western countries, many of whom once counted as close friends of Israel. Don't you think that that, at least, that last thing that you say there about its growing status as a pariah in the West would disturb the Israelis? Or are they so complacent about American continuing support that that doesn't even bother them?
Right. I think that's the key factor here. Until and unless America, Israel's close friend, says the game is up and we are going to help you secure your very own future, but it's going to be very painful, meaning we are not going to support the settlement project anymore, and if that means we have to curtail or cut military aid, we will do so. Unless and until that happens, I think there will be no real incentive to for Israel to understand that time is running short on its own existence as a Jewish state. That I think that's the case, though there is indeed a ratcheting up of pressure, especially in the West, in Western Europe. Ironically enough, the Arab states do not, at this current moment, represent much of a force of pressure on Israel. They seem rather undisturbed by the pace of events, with the exception perhaps of the Egyptians in pushing the Hamas-Fatah agreement. But I think ultimately that what is the game changer still, even in an era of declining American power, is a clear American directive by a second-term president to Israeli leaders saying this cannot continue anymore. It's both politically and morally unacceptable and something needs to change. That's probably a process that's decades away. And by that time, the region between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea will increasingly become one polity. Israel will then really have to decide, does it imagine itself as a democracy, or does it want to hold on to its notion of itself as a Jewish state, if it retains all of that land between the Jordan and the Mediterranean?
Right.
At that point, we're faced with a very, very dire choice. And it seems to me that we're moving in that direction unless something dramatic alters the balance of power. That's where we'll be in the next quarter to half century.
So effectively, you're saying that Netanyahu's policies have led us all in the Middle East to a one-state solution.
I think that's right, ironically enough. And it should be said that virtually every Israeli government since 1967, since the 67 war, when Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, Golan, and Sinai as part of its military advance, every Israeli government has committed itself to building settlements in the occupied territories, and thus is party to, indeed complicit in, this path to a one-state solution. I happen to believe that the two-state solution is the best around, or as Churchill famously said of democracy, maybe the worst solution except for all of the others. But
right.
It doesn't seem to me that that's where we're headed. It seems to me the momentum has been almost exclusively in one direction. The Israeli withdrawal from Sinai is an exception. The Israeli disengagement from Gaza in 2005 is a partial exception because of the terms under which that was negotiated, mainly completely unilaterally.
Right.
And I think Israel, it may well be that Sharon's last vision was, in fact, to withdraw unilaterally to assure chaos in Gaza, at least initially, severance of Gaza from the West Bank politically, and the right of Israel to act militarily in Gaza whenever it sees fit to do so.
Right. It's an occupation without an occupation.
Right, right. And the blockade that was introduced in 2007 and continues a form of occupation by another name. So I think, while Netanyahu's own lack of political imagination is quite striking, that this is part of a longer-term process that will be very difficult to reverse. And I say that with great sadness, because it seems to me at this point the division of historic Palestine into two states for two peoples would be the most equitable of all solutions.
Well, thank you so much, David. It's been really nice having you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Amy.
We've been speaking with David Myers. He's the chairman of UCLA's History Department, and he writes about the conflict in Israel and Palestine for the Jewish Journal. His most recent article was called After Gaza, The Trail of Destruction and Its Costs. We're going to take a station break right now and then come back to Mike Farrell, and we'll be talking to Mike about problems with capital punishment in the United States today. Welcome back. I'm Amy Willens, sitting in for Ian Masters. We're going to talk about the death penalty today. I have a personal interest in the death penalty because my grandfather was the prosecutor in the Lindbergh case back in the 1930s. And at the end of that trial, a German immigrant was found guilty of the kidnapping and killing of the Lindbergh baby. And he was sent to the electric chair. And I was a little girl when I first found out about this. So my life was filled with news clips of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who was the supposed kidnapper, sitting in the dock and being highly questioned by my grandfather, and I knew what his fate was. So I've always been an opponent of the death penalty. And I have here today with me on this segment Mike Farrell. Mike is a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of Army Captain B.J. Hunnicutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the weekly NBC series Providence. On the social action scene, he is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks very much, Amy. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here. You know, I feel that there is a slow but steadily increasing revulsion with the death penalty across the country. We shouldn't be the last country in the developed world to execute people. In Europe, there are no countries that have the death penalty except for Belarus. 18 states in the United States have repealed the death penalty. So I wonder if you feel the way I do, that this is a movement, it's an abolitionist-style movement, and that it is continuing throughout the nation. I know in California it's quite important.
Indeed. I think the death penalty is on the ropes. I think it's a matter of time. In my view, it only exists because of political cowardice. I think that the public is way ahead of the politicians, which is not a surprise to anybody who's been involved in political activism. But the reasons for it, for its demise or its slow death, are many. But what is clear is the polls show support is dropping, the number of people on death row is dropping, the number of people sentenced to death is dropping. Everything is demonstrating clearly that the politicians are way behind the ball on this, and that the public, for different reasons in different parts of the country, is way ahead of them. And it's hideous on some levels to be aware of that, aware, as many of us have been for so long, how the harm this process does, and know that before we actually see the end of it, there are going to be more senseless judicial homicides, as it was once known.
Right. But is the whole reason not to execute because you might execute an innocent person? Isn't there a further, deeper reason to oppose the death penalty?
In my view, I think it's well. First of all, it's racist. We all know that it's applied grotesquely and inappropriately against people of color, and also only against the poor. And it's hideously expensive. But in my view, it's a question of morality. Personally, I believe that that killing people is immoral, and I think that we as a state, we as a nation, to continue to do this in 32 of our states, we are, I believe, sort of doing significant harm to the moral fabric of the nation. And I think we are also in this process asking people, or actually ordering people, to kill for us.
Right.
To strap people onto a gurney, or to strap into an electric chair, or go through all the processes that we know about, the hanging or...
Right, the executioner.
Gassing or firing squads. And I think the harm we are visiting on those people, the death squads, if you will, mm-hmm. the killing teams, is an unconscionable thing to ask of people. We also, you know, you have the anecdotal information that people will say, well, but, you know, I would volunteer because of my horror at having somebody in my family killed.
Right.
You know, nobody can argue that somebody is so furious, so hurt, so wounded, so angered by the death of a loved one that he or she wants to see the perpetrator dead. But that doesn't mean that we as a nation should carry out that person's
revenge, right?
At that moment, need for revenge. So what I try to get people to understand is the actual process of the death penalty is hurting us all. I believe it is responsible, if you track it back, for much of the degradation of our moral standing in our country and in the world. We've said that under certain circumstances it's okay to take a life, and then we decided it was okay to torture, and now we're deciding it's okay to drop, to murder by drone. And we are slipping into a kind of black hole of monstrosity that I think we haven't fully taken an appreciation of.
Well, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate the moral quality of the argument, and I'm so glad to see it related to these further outrages that the government has been committing, and I think that's accurate. We really appreciate your agreeing to be on the show today, Mike. So nice to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking to Mike Farrell, who's the president of Death Penalty Focus, which tries to get grassroots support to end the death penalty in California and in the United States. We're going to take a station break now, and when we come back, I'll be talking to Josh Schenck about my favorite Beatle, John Lennon. Welcome back to the show. This is Amy Willens sitting in for Ian Masters. Guess what? Today should be an international holiday. It's John Lennon's birthday. In case you don't know who John Lennon was, he was one of the Beatles. He was the angry, brilliant, articulate Beatle who would be 74 today. People talk about disruption in the new technological world of today, but John Lennon was an early disruptor. He said he was more popular than Jesus, causing an uproar. He openly used drugs. He had a bed in for peace. He put ads in the New York Times saying that war was over as long as we just wanted it to be over. He was always unapologetic, and I always like to celebrate him. He was a big hero to me when I was a young girl. I was a fan, but I didn't want to fall in love with him. I wanted to be him. So today, to talk to us about John and Paul, and the Beatles' stubborn, enduring legacy, we're going to hear from Joshua Schenck, the writer of a book called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. He's also the writer of an excerpt of that book, The Power of Two, which appeared in the Atlantic Monthly recently and was devoted to the creative collaboration of John Lennon with someone whom Lennon once called his old estranged fiancé, Paul McCartney. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Oh, hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. Why do you think that the Beatles' music continues to resonate with babies and grannies alike?
It's a great question, and I think about this all the time. My nephew, a couple of years ago, for the first time in his life, was old enough to sort of choose what would go on his walls. And they took down all these art posters that my sister had put up, and he, the very first thing he wanted on his walls was a Beatles poster. It was just a really strong sign of it being passed to yet another generation. I think that it goes to, of course, the quality of the work, the quality of what John and Paul produced together and then separately and together in this dance between them, and that was, you know, developed in the studio with the band and with the engineers. But there's a very distinct sensibility that John and Paul shared that allowed them to dig very deep into musical traditions like the blues and rock and roll and Motown, but also keep a kind of ironic distance from it. So the work has this kind of sheen, this kind of glimmer of reflecting on these traditions. They never fully kind of dive down deep into, you know, any one thing in particular. And so I think it has a kind of life and liveliness that allows it to sort of move through many different eras.
That's interesting. So in a way, their distance from their roots is what makes it still valuable and new all the time.
Yeah, there's a constant sense of humor. There's a constant, and there's also just a constant sort of drive for something different and unusual and a drive to distinctiveness. And this is one of the ironies of the Lennon and McCartney combination, because, you know, we sometimes fear that being with another person will sort of flatten us out and sort of bring us to, you know, lowest common denominator. But in the great pairs like John and Paul, two people working together actually become more and more distinct as individuals.
As long as it's a battle. right? As long as there's a kind of a battle going on or a rivalry that makes them compete to their highest level.
That's a lot of the energy between them, too, and a lot of what makes it so interesting that they were simultaneously trying to outdo one another, top the other. Each one wanted the A side of the single, but they also were elevating each other and becoming more and more entwined, even as they became more and more competitive.
Well, you talked in your article in The Atlantic about the folly, you say, of asserting that one or the other of Lennon and McCartney is the true author of any particular Beatles song. Why is that folly? Because I know that my children are always coming to me and saying, I bet that one was written by John. I bet that one was written by Paul. And they're always right. They know the personalities of the two men better even than I do.
Sure. Well, you can open up the partnership and you can take it apart the way you could take apart a clock. You could see the individual gears, the John-ness and the Paul-ness of these things. But in order for the clock to work, in order for the machine to work, you have to put them back together again and see how they were constantly affecting each other, influencing each other, refining what the other did. So you look at a song like Strawberry Fields Forever, and it's a very John song. It's associative. It's lyrical. It's philosophical. But that song was developed, enriched, you know, dramatically enlarged in combination with Paul. And even a song like A Day in the Life, it's popularly known as two fragments that were joined. But that's actually not the way it worked. It's true that they had initiated two fragments on their own, but John brought his fragment to Paul, as he often did, and they rounded it out. And then in that conversation, it together prompted an idea for this other little fragment that Paul had. And then, again, in the joining and the stitching, it was immensely collaborative in the studio. It's easy to forget the hundreds and hundreds of hours these guys would spend sometimes working on a single song. And they were able to do that in part because they just enjoyed each other's company that much and respected each other and were, frankly, disinterested in other people that much. I mean, they could have been with anyone, but they preferred to be with the other guy.
And yet one has the feeling still of that kind of embattled mentality. Do you remember the quote you used from George Martin about the rope?
Yes, sure, that they were like two guys pulling on a tug of rope, each trying to, you know, pull the other one over, but smiling all the while. And he said that it was the tension that made for the bond.
Right, and the game can't go on unless there's the tension.
That's right. So they're both those elements. There is a kind of oppositional energy, but it's also very pleasurable. And part of the pleasure is that they're doing such good work, and they didn't, and not just side by side, but it's the way they got into each other's heads. One of the most intriguing exchanges for me is if you look at Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, which Paul has said was an answer to Strawberry Fields Forever, and very clearly reflects it in its structure and its form, although it reflects it as though through a funhouse mirror because it's coming from a very different place. The timing is very particular. They worked on Strawberry Fields Forever for many weeks in the studio, and exactly 7 days after they had working cut, Paul brought in Penny Lane. If you flash forward to the White Album sessions, that was on the sessions that began Strawberry Fields Forever, or excuse me, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. If you flash forward to the White Album sessions, John did Revolution, and again, he brought in the song, and they worked on it. They worked on it for many weeks. And exactly 7 days after they had a working cut, Paul brought in Blackbird. And Blackbird is a really interesting song if you're trying to identify authorship, because this is a Paul McCartney song. He wrote it apparently without any overt influence from John. He recorded it alone in a little room at the back of Abbey Road where there's not room enough for other people. It was just Paul and an engineer. And yet it's so clearly an answer to John and a part of an ongoing dialogue. And this is what happens when two people work together at that level. It's not just what they say to each other. It's the way they get in each other's heads.
But I guess you're reminding me again why I always think of John Lennon's birthday, but not so often think of Paul McCartney's birthday, and why I honor John as an early influence on myself, and that's because he was the angry one. He was intransigent, he was dedicated, he was politically alert, and he would come in with these songs that were kind of protest songs. Certainly Strawberry Fields is a protest against jolly old England, and Penny Lane is a apotheosis of that kind of feeling for England. And same with Revolution and Blackbird. They're opposite sides of the political coin. Didn't Paul McCartney, in a sense, flatten out John Lennon so that we could feel that it was commercial and acceptable and lovely?
I think that's a really interesting question. My instinct is to turn it around. John Lennon said very clearly that he was on track to be just like his father if it weren't for the Beatles, and what he really meant was if it weren't for Paul, because that's where the Beatles really began. And if you look at him as a young man, yeah, he was talented, he was charismatic, other kids wanted to be around him, but he had no outlet for this fantastic energy. He was drawn in multiple directions. He couldn't apply himself. He was a guy who could start a lot of things but had a hard time finishing them. And he had a very hard time putting things into form. He wasn't patient. And that's what Paul did for John, was become a kind of channel for him and teach him pop structure and bring his impulses and allow them to come into a form. And that is what we appreciate and enjoy. And it's very easy to say, you know, you get a container, and then you take out of the container the thing you really want, and you discard the container, and it's easy to disregard it. But you wouldn't have gotten the thing in the first place if it weren't for the container. And this is often the case, you know, between two creative people, one of whom is paying attention to structure and form and, you know, attention to the audience and attention to the context, that person is maligned as overly conservative or poppy or something, when in fact it's the dialectic between the sort of the angry, you know, disruptive energy and the containing energy that makes things really work. And I think, you know, flash forward, it's true that John did some terrific work, you know, in the early years after he stopped working with Paul, but he really just came to a total stoppage. And this idea that he just preferred not to make music, that he was glad to be a house husband, I don't buy that at all. He was very eager to work, but he always needed someone around him who would goad him, who would push him, and who would draw him out. And Paul McCartney had done that for him in a very rare way, with
yes,
a lot of love and a lot of respect. And
if you listen to that last album, and you listen to Watching the Wheels, it's as though Paul McCartney is still collaborating with him on that song.
Well, yeah, and the story, I have this moment in my book that apparently, I mean, Paul had this huge hit. It's not one of his memorable songs, but it was on the radio all the time. Apparently John heard it on the radio, and he said to his, you know, the guy driving his car, you know, this is just driving me nuts. I've got to get back to work. This competition between them definitely went on through the 70s. Alongside, I mean, they were estranged, but there was also an enormous amount of affection, and it's really a very sad, sad thing that they never worked together again, because it wasn't that they didn't have the desire.
Right.
And in fact, when John roused himself from this 5-year period where he was producing nothing, and he made Double Fantasy with Yoko, he was very clear that he was coming back to music, and he intended to write again with Paul. They were going to record again for a Ringo album in the spring, and he hoped that George would come along too. And you know, that seemed very likely, and of course the tragedy of the assassination prevented it.
Yeah, prevented so much for all of us.
Yeah.
I love that image of George and Ringo as kind of the children of the divorce who could bring them back together again.
it was just a very strange series of circumstances that kept them apart. Actually, George was a big part of the problem, because long after John had reconciled with Paul and was speaking about him with a great deal of affection. George still really nursed a grudge against Paul, and then and he would also flame out sometimes in anger at John. George wrote a memoir in which he didn't credit John nearly as much as John wanted, and John was very wounded. And
he was the adolescent son of the two, you know. You know, at this time of year, every year, I try to think of what John Lennon would be doing now if he hadn't died when he was 40 years old. You know, I look at the world and I think, where would he be placing himself now? What do you think he would be doing, Josh?
That's a great question. You know, I think it really depends on who he was around. He's a paradoxical figure because he's so idiosyncratic, he's so distinct, he's so his own person, but he always needed a partner. When he was a little boy, he took over this gang in his neighborhood, and there were four kids in the gang, and he made one of the kids his alter ego, his deputy, and he loved combining his name with this other kid. It was John Lennon and Pete Shotton, and he called them Shannon and Lawton. And when he got together with Paul, he very quickly decided that everything they did would be 50-50. And they decided that on a handshake, and then they wrote it into a legal agreement that it was Lennon and McCartney, or actually in the beginning, McCartney and Lennon. That's a whole other story. But he definitely, he threw himself in with Paul. And when he got together with Yoko, he was very conscious that he was asking her to be his partner in life and a creative partner too. And there was a period where he and Yoko split up, and that's when he was really most, you know, kind of inflamed with his desire to work with Paul again. And then he got back together with Yoko, and to some real extent, he had to choose between them. So that to me is the real question. Who would he have gotten mixed up with? I mean, the radical stuff that he did when he first got to New York. Yes, I mean, this was a man who had no trouble, you know, speaking boldly to authority, and he was suited for it. But what he said is that it was an accident of history that the Yippies met him when he got to the Village, and they were just the first people to get to him, and he fell in with them, and he started playing with them and being part of that protest crowd. So
your argument is that he's a collaborator. He always has to have someone to collaborate with. He couldn't collaborate with two people 50-50 because that would be three people collaborating 50-50. So things kind of fell apart with Lennon and McCartney and Ono. And that now,
yes,
today he would be looking for another partner if he weren't still with Yoko. Well, thank you so much, Josh. I really appreciate your being here with us.
Thank you, Amy. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Schenck. He's the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. And also, he wrote an article called The Power of Two, which was recently excerpted in the Atlantic Monthly and was devoted to the creative collaboration of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Amy Willens, sitting in for Ian Masters. You can follow me on Twitter at Amy Willens, and you can listen back to the program at ianmasters.com, and also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. Look forward to next week when Jessica Levinson and Jonathan Taplin will be sitting in. Bye for now.